You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 206 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 lectures translated by Matthew Barton, entitled The Human Being as Spiritual Being, Evolving Through the Course of History. This is Lecture 3, given in Dornach on the 24th of July, 1921. That fracture in human nature I have spoken of is something you also find manifesting in the whole of daily human life. You find it, above all, if you objectively study the relationship between two human capacities, which, even superficially examined, show themselves to partake both of the life of the soul and the life of the body. The capacity of memory, on the one hand, is an important reality in human soul life, but one equally bound up with the body. Then, on the other hand, there is a power in human life whose nature is scrutinized less, since it is one to which people surrender more naively, without testing or even analyzing it in more detail. The power of human love. We must preface what we say here by stating that when we examine such matters in relation to human nature, firstly, and then in relation to the human being's relationship with the world, we must be clear that we have to start from reality rather than from some kind of idea or hypothesis. I have often given a perhaps somewhat banal comparison for the latter. Someone sees a paper knife and thinks, quote, oh, that's a knife, and a knife is for cutting food, close quote. And so he takes the paper knife and tries to cut food with it, because it's a, in quotes, knife. This is roughly the way scientific people think about death or birth in humans and animals, although since such people are held in high esteem, few would credit this. Sometimes such hypotheses are extended even to plants, too. They form ideas about this roughly in the same way as they do about a knife, and then apply such an idea, which of course represents a certain series of events, to the study of death in human beings, in animals, and in plants. They do not consider that the general concept of death, in quotes, might be something quite different in each case, in humans and animals. We need to start from the reality of the animal and the reality of the human being, not from the way death appears and is then represented by a particular generalizing concept. Ideas relating to memory are forged in a similar way. We can see this especially where, in the quest to establish similarities between humans and animals, the concept of memory is applied to both in an undifferentiated way. Even very famous professors have done this, such as Otto Liebermann. They describe, for instance, how an elephant on its way to a watering hole is in some way antagonized by a person it passes. The elephant continues on its way, but as it returns and sees the same person standing there, it sprays the man with water from its trunk. The investigator says that in such a case, the elephant has taken note of what happened and stored it away in its memory. Certainly, external appearances can easily mislead science here, though no more easily, we might say, than trying to eat food with a paper knife. We always have to start from reality, not from ideas gained from a particular sequence of phenomena, which are then randomly transferred to a different set of phenomena. People usually do not see how widespread such methodological errors are in contemporary scientific research. Our human capacity for memory has to be understood in terms of human nature itself. Here it is necessary that we first establish a means of observing how memory itself develops through the course of life. If we can study this, we can see that in the infant, memory comes to expression in a way quite different from later on. from the age of 6, 7, or 8. At this later age, memory acquires a more soulful character, whereas in infancy, we can clearly observe how this faculty of memory is bound up with organic conditions and gradually unfolds, works itself free from these. If we study the relationship between memories and the forming of concepts in childhood, we will find how this forming of concepts very much involves what the child experiences through sense perceptions of his surroundings, through all 12 of the kinds of sense perception I described. It is delightful, as well as highly significant, to see how the concepts the child forms are entirely dependent on experiences to which he is exposed, and especially on the way people in his surroundings conduct themselves. In the years we are considering here, the child is an imitator, even as regards the concepts he develops. By contrast, we can easily observe how the capacity for memory rises more from the inward nature of childhood development, how it is connected, rather, with the child's whole bodily constitution, and actually very little with a sensory constitution, and thus the constitution of the head. Here we will be able to trace an intimate connection between the child's nature and his either more or less normal blood formation, blood nutrition. We can easily discern that children who have a tendency for anemia find it harder to develop the capacity for memory. On the other hand, we can observe that such a child has fewer difficulties with forming concepts, ideas. I can only point to these things in general, for really everyone who receives these observational guidelines then has to seek and confirm them through life itself. They will then discover how the development of concepts in the child does indeed arise from the organization of the human head, that is, from the neurosensory organization, thus from sensory experiences and perceptions. But that, on the other hand, what interweaves with this formation of concepts as faculty of memory develops from the rest of the organism other than the head organism. And if we continue these observations, if we try to investigate especially the different ways memory forms in children who either tend to be small and stocky, or those who shoot upwards, then we find that there is indeed a clear connection between phenomena of growth in general and the developing power of human memory. Now, on earlier occasions, I said that the development of the human head, as such, shows itself to be a metamorphosis of a person's organic form other than the head in a previous life. In other words, the head we carry on our shoulders in one life on earth is the transformed body, apart from the head, especially the transformed organism of metabolism and limbs from a previous life. Of course, we should not picture this materialistically. This has nothing to do with the materialized contents of an organism, but with the form and the interplay of forces at work in it. The nature of someone's organism of metabolism and limbs in one life becomes their head in the next life, metamorphosed and transformed through the life between death and a new birth. And so now, once we see that a child's capacity to form concepts and ideas depends on this forming of the head, we can see that such faculties are, to a degree, connected with a former life. And there's a drawing. On the other hand, the faculty of memory, incorporating itself into us, rises from what we initially receive as our organism of metabolism and limbs during our present earth life. Here, two different things are brought together. One that we bring with us from a former life, and one, the faculty of memory, that we acquire by receiving and incorporating a new organism. You will understand, therefore, that the memory we possess for use between birth and death, which is acquired during our present life, is not sufficient as it stands for looking back to life before birth, the life of a previous existence, In describing a methodology of these things, it is invariably necessary, as I always stress, to fathom the nature of memory and its capacities, and to learn to recognize clearly that memory is something serving us between birth and death, yet equally to see that we need to develop a higher faculty, which entirely akin to memory, is able to trace the origins of what is elaborated in us as the capacity to form concepts. Abstract theorists substitute mere phrases for realities. They say such things as that mathematical concepts, since they do not need to be acquired through experience, or since their truth does not need to be proven from experience, are a priori concepts. This is a phrase that's used, a priori, meaning prior to or preceding experience. It's a term you can hear repeatedly from adherents of Kant. And yet this a priori signifies nothing more than that we experienced these concepts in former lives. There are no less experiences for that, acquired by humanity during the course of its evolution. It is just that humanity today finds itself at a stage of evolution in which most people, at least in modern civilization, bring these mathematical concepts with them and need them only to be reawoken. The means needed to awaken mathematical concepts in children is markedly different from that required to teach children ideas and concepts gained from external experience, in which the capacity for memory plays a major role. Especially if we can acquire a certain capacity to discern the peculiarities and particularities of human evolution, then we can discern and distinguish two types of young children: those who bring a great deal with them from former lives on earth, to whom it is therefore easy to teach concepts and ideas, and others who are less adept at forming concepts, but who instead easily observe the qualities of outward things, who therefore easily absorb what they can receive through their own observations. But the faculty of memory plays into this, for it is not easy to learn outward things in the way they have to be taught in schools. It is easy to form a concept or idea, of course, but without a marked capacity for memory, what is learned cannot easily be retained and reproduced. Briefly, we can clearly discern here the interplay of two currents or streams in human evolution. So, what is this due to? Remember that on the one hand we shape our concept-forming capacity through our head organization. Why? If you gain insight into the human head organization, you'll be able to see why. This human head organization emerges at a relatively early stage in fetal life, before the substantial part of the rest of our organism has joined it. Embryology certainly offers evidence of what anthroposophy states in relation to human evolution. But you do not need to look back as far as this. You need only consider a fully grown human being. Look at his head organization, and you can see that it possesses, firstly, something that is the most perfect, relatively speaking, in the whole human organization. Well, people might dispute this, but what cannot be disputed, if you observe it in the right way, is this: that in our experiencing of the world, we relate quite differently to our head than to the rest of our organism. We feel the rest of our organism very differently from our head. Basically, the head extinguishes itself for our own life of soul. We have far more organic awareness of the whole of the rest of our organism than we do of our head. Our head is really the part of us that extinguishes itself within our organism. This head also lifts itself out of the rest of our connection with the world, doing so inwardly already through our cerebral organization. I have often pointed to the fact that the brain possesses a weight which would crush all that lies beneath it if it did not float in the cerebrospinal fluid, so that it loses the whole weight a body would have if it consisted of cerebral spinal fluid and was as big as the brain. Thus we can say that the brain's weight is reduced in a ratio of between 1,300 and 1,400 grams to 20 grams. But this means that insofar as we stand upon the earth, we possess our natural weight, but that the brain is lifted out of these conditions of gravity, not absolutely so, but inasmuch as it sits inside us. Yet even if you do not consider these internal conditions, if you study the external form, or, as one might say, the whole way in which people carry heads on their shoulders, it is true to say that this head is rather like a lord or lady who sits in a carriage. The carriage moves along, but as it does so, the lord or lady inside it can sit there serenely, needing to make no effort to be conveyed to their destination. The head has roughly the same relationship with the rest of our organism. There are many further such things that might be said here, all of which show that our head is in a way lifted out of the relationship we have with the rest of the world. And this is because we possess in our head a physical reconfiguration of what our soul experienced through the rest of our organism in a former life on earth. If we study the four main aspects of our human organization as they exist in the head, physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I, capital, we can say that really the I alone possesses a certain independence in the head. The other supersensible bodies have in fact created their reflection in this human head, in its physical form. I once provided a striking proof of this, and I'd like to refer to it again here in merely theoretical terms by recounting a story. As I once told you many years ago on the occasion of the founding of the Giordano Bruno Society, I attended a lecture on the brain given by a fully signed-up, ardent materialist. Naturally, he outlined the brain's structure and demonstrated how basically this brain structure gives expression to the psyche. This is something that can be done and done well. Now, the president of the society was a high school director who was not a materialist, but a dyed-in-the-wool Herbartianist who dismissed everything other than this Herbartian philosophy. And he said that, as a Herbartian, he could gladly accept everything that had been said in the lecture, but could not take what the lecturer had described in materialistic terms as the actual matter or substance of the brain. The delineation of parts of the brain, connective fibers, and so forth, was something the Herbartian could gladly accept. He liked the drawing perfectly well, he, a Herbartian and non-materialist, since he said he needed only to substitute complexes of thought for what the other had designated as portions of the brain. Thus, instead of cerebral fibers, he would designate the same areas as association fibers, connections in the psyche, thought complexes. And where the other pointed to neurons, cerebral connections, he would point to associative threads. For instance, those configurations which John Stuart Mill so wonderfully imagined, connections passing from one thought to the next. In this view, the soul spins itself all kinds of connecting threads between thought complexes in an entirely automatic and ungoverned way. Herbart himself describes this very well. So the two could agree perfectly well about the drawing. Why? Simply because the human brain is indeed an extraordinarily good imprint of the soul and spirit. The soul and spirit imprint themselves in the brain. They do so very well, for they have had the whole time between death and a new birth to shape and configure what then wonderfully imprints and expresses the psyche in the brain's externally sculpted forms. If we now pass from this anecdote to an account of psychology, such as that given by Theodor Sihin, we find that he too describes the parts of the brain in materialistic terms. And the whole thing strikes one as extremely credible. It is also done extremely conscientiously. This can indeed be done. If we consider the life of the human intellect, the life of thought, we find a very precise imprint of it in the brain. But with a psychology of this kind, we do not get as far as feeling, and still less as far as will. If we examine a psychology such as that of Tzien, we find that for him feeling is nothing more than thought colored by feeling, while will never even figures in this outlook. It does not figure there, since feeling and will have no actual connection with what has been configured in the brain. Feeling is connected with the human being's rhythmic system and is still in full active motion. It is imaged in movements. And will is altogether connected with what formatively arises and disappears again in the metabolism. It cannot reveal itself, as the life of thought can, in reflected imprinted forms. Thus, in the life of thinking, or in the capacity of thinking, we have soul that expresses itself plastically and pictorially in the head. But here we are within the human astral body. And so the human astral body creates its image or reflection in the human head. Only the eye still remains somewhat mobile. The etheric body is very precisely reflected, imaged forth in the human head, and the physical body still more so. By contrast, in the rest of the organism, for instance in the rhythmic system, the astral body itself is not imaged forth at all, but only the etheric body and the physical body. And in the metabolic organism, only the physical body is replicated. In summary, we can picture it like this. In the head you have physical body, etheric body, astral body, such that these are replicated in the physical, so that you can actually demonstrate this replication in the head's physical forms. Seeing these three forms in the human head is the only way to understand it. The nature of the eye still retains a free relationship here. See drawing. If we pass on now to the rest of the human organization, thus, for instance, to the respiratory organization, we find the physical body and the etheric body imaged or reflected there. But the astral body and the eye are not reflected in this way, and in a sense remain free. And in the human being's organism of limbs and metabolism, we have the physical body as such, while the eye, astral body, and etheric body are free. We have to distinguish here between the presence of these bodies and their either free or bound condition. Naturally, it is not true to say that the head is not dependent on an astral body and etheric body. These, of course, permeate the human head, but they are not free within it. Rather, they are replicated, reflected in its organization. By contrast, the astral body is free, for instance, in the whole rhythmic system, especially in the breathing. It is intrinsically active there. Here, it not only fills it, but is actively at work. Now, let us relate two things to each other. The one is the fact that we can ascertain a relationship between the human capacity of memory and the organization apart from and outside the head, and that we must also seek our feeling and will organization outside of the head. And now we see how the soul's world of feeling joins together with the world of memory. If you empirically, truly experientially, examine the connection between the life of feeling and the faculty of memory, you will discover the connection between them to be a very close one. The manner in which we can remember things is largely dependent on how, thanks to our organization apart from the head, we can participate in things, the degree to which we can immerse ourselves in things, live within them. If we are head people, first and foremost, we will understand a great deal but remember little by having merged with them. I'll put it like this. There is a significant connection between the capacity for feeling and the faculty of memory. But at the same time, we see that the human organization, apart from the head, comes close to the head organization at the beginning of fetal development. There we are almost entirely head to start with. The rest are appendages. When the child is born, just think how imperfect the rest of the baby's organism is compared to the head. But it annexes itself to the head. And in life between birth and death, the rest of our organism comes increasingly to resemble the head organization. This increasing resemblance coming to expression particularly in the eruption of the second teeth. Our first teeth, the milk teeth, as they are called, originate more from the head organization, while the second dentition involves the whole human being. Spiritual science discovers this to be indisputably the case, and if the right methods are used, it can also be demonstrated in anatomical and physiological terms too. The teeth that originated more from the head organization are expelled, and the rest of our organism is active in the second dentition. We have a kind of physical image or reflection in the first teeth, while the second teeth relate to the forming of concepts and memory. We can say that the milk teeth are formed more from the head organization, such as concepts are, except that the latter, of course, are shifted upward into the realm of intellect and spirit, and the second teeth are drawn more from our whole human organization, like the capacity for memory. We just have to be able to trace subtle distinctions within the human organization. If you consider such things, you will be able to see that we can only really comprehend the shaping and configuring of material substance, especially in the organic realm, if we grasp it as a spiritual configuring. A dyed-in-the-wool materialist naturally studies the material human being. But if we are intent on seeking reality, we leave aside our materialistic preconceptions and observe how this human head of ours is formed and configured initially out of the supersensible realm, and that it arises through metamorphosis of a former life on earth. And then, likewise, we can see the rest of the organism as attaching to the head from the world in which a child is now placed in a new life on earth, albeit likewise configured out of the spiritual supersensible aspect of this world. It is important to attend to such a view and perspective. You see, it is important for us not to speak in abstract terms of a material and a spiritual world, but to draw our insights from the way in which the material world proceeds and arises from the world of spirit. To see how the world of spirit is reflected and imaged forth in the world of matter. It is not enough to dwell in abstractions here. We have to move on into tangible realities. We have to be able to develop insight into the differences between the human head and the rest of our organism. Then one sees in the forms of the human head, also in how it emerges and proceeds from the spiritual world, something different from the rest of the organism. The rest of the organism is, you see, certainly annexed, joined to us in each life on earth, whereas we take with us the form of the head right into its shaping as the outcome of former lives on earth. If you reflect on this fact, you will see how inept objections to anthroposophy are, such as the one recently made. In a report published in the current issue of the title Threefolding Journal, you can read about a debate on anthroposophy in Munich, instigated by Eucken, an acclaimed author, despite the journalistic trivia he puts his name to. Eucken objected to anthroposophy, saying that it is materialistic, and substantiating this claim by asserting, fatuously, that whatever one can perceive is material in nature. Naturally, such a definition allows one to prove whatever one wants, although it shows ignorance of the methodology of proof. We should grasp rather how the material world, as it emerges from spirit, can be seen as a testimony to a world of spirit. But now, and I don't want to go further than this today, if in turn you consider how we can observe this growth of memory in its affinity with the other growth forces in the human being, then we can note an interplay between what one otherwise calls material and what, especially from the age of 7 or 8, develops in someone as their life of spirit and soul. It really is the case that what later appears in a more abstract and intellectual form in the power of memory is first involved in growth. It truly is the same power. The same mode of observation must be used here as is used, let us say, when people speak of latent and free heat. Heat that is released from its latent condition behaves in an external way, like the power that appears tangibly for inner life as that of memory, which in the years of infancy underlies phenomena of growth. What underlies these growth phenomena in early childhood possesses the same nature as later appears in its more intrinsic form in the power and capacity of memory. In the autumn course here at the Goetheanum, I elaborated on this in more detail. And there you can see how we can discover by such means an intimate relationship between the soul spiritual and the physical corporeal realm. How, in other words, we can discover in the faculty of memory something that appears to us on the one hand as soul spiritual in nature, but on the other hand in a different cosmic content as the power of growth. But if you reflect on the human capacity for love, you find the very opposite of this. This ability to love, which is on the one hand certainly bound up with corporeality, can also in turn be seen as the most soulful function of all, just like the power of memory. And so in memory and in love, I will elaborate on this in more detail in later lectures, you actually have something that reveals experientially the interplay between spirit and body. And you can also relate this to the human being's whole relationship with the world. We did this already in the case of memory by relating the idea or mental picture to former earth lives. But the power of memory, on the other hand, to our current life on earth. In subsequent lectures, we will see that the same can be done with the power of love. We can show how this develops in our present life, but then passes through the life between death and a new birth and on into a subsequent life. We can see how it is this precisely which works on into a subsequent life on earth to metamorphose the rest of the human organism other than the head. Why are we considering such matters at all? It is because we need a means today to build a bridge between the spirit soul and the physical body. Within the spirit soul realm, we experience morality, as opposed to the natural necessity we experience in the physical corporeal realm. If one is honest in one's thinking, modern views discern no bridge between these two domains. And yesterday I pointed out that because no such bridge exists, people distinguish between what they call real knowledge, which concerns natural causality, and the mere tenets of faith, with their moral content. These two realms stand alongside one another without connection. Natural causality on the one hand, and the life of soul and spirit on the other. But in order to develop full consciousness again of humankind, we certainly need to establish a bridge between the one and the other. And here, above all, we need to recognize that the world of morality cannot survive without invoking freedom, while the natural world cannot exist without natural necessity. The one proceeds and emerges from the other. Actually, there could be no science if natural imperatives did not exist. If one phenomenon did not arise from another in the natural world, everything would be arbitrary and random, and there could be no science. Defying scientific laws, anything could arise and follow from anything else, couldn't it? So it is clear that science exists initially by studying how one thing follows from another. Yet if this natural causality were universal, moral freedom would be impossible, could not exist. And the awareness of this moral freedom in the realm of soul and spirit is a reality which every human being experiences. The contrast between what we experience as morality within our psyche and natural causality is not a logical contradiction, but a matter of lived experience. We continually live with this contradiction. It is part and parcel of life. If we honestly examine what we experience, we have to say that natural causality, natural imperatives, have to exist. And as human beings, we are subject to them. But our inner life of soul and spirit contrasts with and contradicts this. We know that we can make decisions, can follow moral ideals that do not exist for us within natural causality. This is a living contradiction for us, a matter of lived experience. Those who fail to acknowledge that such contradictions exist in life overlook life's full reality. But putting it like this is very abstract. We always bring to bear on life a kind of outlook, a conception of things. We make our way through life and continually feel ourselves in some way at odds with outward nature. It can seem as if we were powerless, as if we are obliged to feel ourselves in discord with the natural world. Such discords and contradictions can assume tragic proportions nowadays in some people. For example, I once knew someone who was convinced that we are fully incorporated into the world's natural necessity and subject to it. Of course, it is possible to hold such a view in theory, and yet not bother oneself much about it in the rest of one's being. Then one trivializes one's experience of life and remains unaffected by any sense of inner tragedy. But as I said, I knew someone who saw natural necessity everywhere in the world, and believed that as human beings we are wholly subject to it. Science does indeed compel us to accept this. But at the same time, this person thought natural necessity allows bubbles to rise up in us, a sort of froth that gives us the false sense of a free soul life. We must see through this, he thought, see the froth for what it is. That too is natural necessity. This is the terrible illusion that plagues humankind and establishes pessimism in human nature. Those who have little sense of how such an outlook can profoundly affect the human soul will not be able to feel either how a living contradiction, such as this, can torment the whole soul, and even give someone the feeling that it is a misfortune to be alive and to experience this at first hand. Thoughtlessness and lack of sensitivity toward scientific certainties, on the one hand, and certainties of faith, on the other, is all that prevents people today from experiencing the inner tragedy of this gulf. This would otherwise be the general state of soul of human beings today, a sense of tragedy in the face of this schism in human nature. But what causes the incapacity that leads to such tragedy? For centuries now in civilization, we have enmeshed ourselves in certain abstract notions, in intellectualism. This intellectualism cannot do other than say at most that natural necessity offers us a chimera of freedom, deceives us in particular ways that we are free. But freedom does not exist. It exists only in our ideas. Against natural necessity, we are in fact powerless. The great question then arises as to whether we are actually free. You will notice that the lectures I have been giving here for several weeks all tend toward this question of whether freedom is a reality. Are we actually powerless in the face of this contradiction? Remember, I said that in human life, we have not only a rising, but also a descending course of evolution, that our intellectual life is not bound up with the forces of growth, but with those of decline and dying, that we need forces of death, of dying, in order to develop our intelligence. Recall that I described a few weeks back the significance of how elements exist in the world with particular affinities and valences, how such elements as carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and sulfur combine to form proteins. I showed what this compound forming is based on, not on chemical process at all, but on chaoticization. You will see that all these reflections point not merely to theoretical contradictions, but to actual processes in human nature. Our lives as human beings are given us not only for experiencing such a contradiction, but rather our inner life is a continual process of destroying what develops as natural causality in the outer natural world. Within us, we do actually cancel natural causality. What appears in the outer world as physical processes, chemical processes, is developed in reverse within us, is developed in a different aspect or direction. Of course, we only realize this when we pay heed to the two realms within us of our upper and lower organism, when we see that what rises from the metabolism is demechanized, dematerialized, dechemicalized by our upper system. If we try to study the process of dematerialization within us, then we find not only a logical, theoretical contradiction, but an actual process at work. We have within us the process of human becoming and development as something that battles against natural causality, and human life as something to which this battle is integral. And the expression of this battle, the expression of what continually unmakes or dissolves physical synthesis, chemical synthesis, and in turn analyzes it, the expression of the analytic life within us, can be summarized in the experience that I am free. In subsequent lectures, we will examine further what I have now presented very briefly, studying the process of human development as one of battle with natural causality, as a reversal of natural causality. The end of Lecture 3.